The following program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Welcome to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. We have two interesting conversations on this episode of Humanities Connection. In just a couple of seconds, you'll hear all about an oral history project at the Museum of Early Trades and Crafts. Then later on in the program, we'll talk about an adult reading program called People and Stories. It's not designed to teach people reading skills. It's designed to ignite a love of literature through short stories and discussions. All of this coming up right now on this episode of Humanities Connection, which is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. History is no longer limited to the study of presidents and generals. That's why oral histories are so important. The New Jersey Council for the Humanities has funded a number of oral history projects. You've heard about many of them on this program, but the one we're going to talk about right now is particularly fascinating to me because it is so broad in scope. And my guest here in the WFDU TNEC studio is Meg Waste, Curator of Education for the Museum of Early Trades and Crafts in Madison, New Jersey. They have something called an incubation grant for an oral history project. And I did tell the audience, Meg, that it's pretty broad in scope, but maybe you can give us some more details. Tell us about your oral history project.
Thank you, Bob. The oral history project was an attempt to involve visitors a little more intimately with the objects on display in the museum. We believe that any of the objects can evoke feelings, memories, reactions from visitors, but we wanted to take it a little further and see how we could learn from the visitors themselves on their memories what those reactions are. And so we selected some objects to do that with.
That's an interesting approach. Very often people will just say, hey, you know, you were at Woodstock, you know, tell us what it was like rolling around in the mud listening to Santana. But in this case, you literally hand something to someone. Or do you have them look at it, or do they visit as a tactile?
We did it in two different ways. With the original entry into the project, we had objects that the visitors could handle. They could pick them up, move them, and interact with them physically. And we also had some objects that could not be touched, but that we had out for them to view.
Give me an idea of what an object might provoke in someone. You had mentioned something about the game Chutes and Ladders and how different people of different ages react in varying ways to holding on to one of these objects.
We put out part of our collection. It's an old game. It was originally produced in the 1840s. It was called Mansion of Happiness. The closest relation we would have today would be the game Chutes and Ladders. Both games parallel because they show if you do good things, you advance. If you do bad things, you go back. And so Mansion of Happiness had the squares on the board. So if someone landed on industry, then they would advance because they're doing hard work. If someone landed on laziness or idleness, then they would slide back to poverty, which would be a life lesson played with a recreational game.
It sounds like a great idea for a 21st century reality show, actually, with that title. And now another episode of Mansion of Happiness. But it is interesting because obviously you're not just testing someone's reaction to the game or to something that is so old. You're testing their reaction to some of the values that are encoded in there too, right? The idea that, well, if you're poor, it's your fault, and if you're rich, it's because you worked hard. Not that there are any other reasons or layers in between, which, of course, most of us don't believe in today, but that was a concept years ago.
Well, with the incubation grant, we've finally narrowed it down to two visitors' reactions, and we have a video on display with the exhibit at the Museum of Early Trades and Crafts. And what was evoked by the board game was the idea of life and its consequences and the random nature of life. And so both visitors responded in ways that things like, I never thought I would be here in this part of my life at this point. Or had I made this choice, my life might have been entirely different. And so the visitors were using the game as an interesting focal point and then going off onto their own memories and reflections of their lives and how their lives have changed based on choices that they've made.
In some of the literature I received from the museum preparing for this conversation with you, it mentions that because of the digital age, a lot may be lost about the late 20th and early 21st centuries. So you're really trying to give people way down the line an idea of what people were like who lived, I don't know, what would be the range, 1930 to 2017, I guess? What would be that range
of people in the oral history
that you're getting? Are you getting people who did live through World War II or the Depression or whatever? Are you getting kids who are high school kids today?
We have quite a range. The director of the museum, Deb Starker, and the curator of collections, Kristen Lapos, and I feel that the it displays and the lessons that go along with the exhibits should appeal to all ages. So a grandfather might bring a grandchild into the museum. Both are looking at the same object, but they're responding in different ways. How the child responds might be totally foreign to the grandfather, and the grandfather's comments might be foreign to the child. But that opens up dialogue also within the members of that family. And that's because they have been looking at artifacts in a display, and it evokes all kinds of memories and discussions that families can have.
Imagine if that's around when that grandchild is a grandfather or a grandmother and looks back at the perspective that they had versus the grandparent whose ideas might have been foreign to them at the time. You know, who knows how that will evolve. It sounds fascinating. Now, when you do, we've explained an incubation grant on past episodes. It's kind of a test run. It's a chance to see if this is going to work. It seems to have worked well. What are you hoping to do with it in terms of being a museum?
We hope to include other objects from our collection into mini exhibits that will draw visitors in to see these things and then to draw further reactions from them so that we can display objects and display video interviews with selected visitors that show how the objects can evoke memories.
And it sounds like just something that's a great way for this to move on. What was the role of our underwriter, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, in all of this?
Wonderful grant writers provide money.
That's
and
a good
for
thing.
That, we are most grateful, most grateful. And that allows us to have the time for meeting, the ability to get equipment. We have a wonderful video display that we were able to purchase with some of the grant money, and that will go on further. So certainly helpful.
Let's talk about your museum in Madison, the Museum of Early Trades and Crafts. Obviously, the name pretty much defines what it would be. You know, learn about blacksmithing or whatever. But give us kind of an overall picture. What are some of these early trades and crafts that you have on exhibition?
The museum was started by a couple who lived in the town of Madison, and they were avid collectors of early Americana. So they wanted to show what life was like in early American times through the tools that people used and the artifacts that were made with these tools. So it focuses on specific craftspeople of early America, the blacksmith, the cooper, the carpenter, the printer, and the objects that those people use. And people see those and get to see, kind of like a mini Williamsburg, very mini Williamsburg, to see the objects on display.
It's really interesting that professions do come and go because today, because of the digital age and what they call disruption, there are so many professions, trades that people thought they'd do it for their whole lifetime. They identify themselves with that. While I also work as a professor, I'm a broadcaster, but the term broadcaster may become outmoded in the digital age as people, you know, go to other means of media. Do you think this has a bit of a message for us today as we get very nervous and disoriented by all this disruption in our job lives?
Well, it's disruption, but it's also evolution. And people's jobs change. I think it's important for visitors to the museum to see a blacksmith creating, or they don't see a blacksmith, but to see the tools a blacksmith used to create things. And then tie that in with 3D printers now, where you can create an object through modern technology. But the roots of those trades are still there, and we have the artifacts to show that.
It's part of the same evolution, and I've always found it important to teach students at the undergraduate level the idea of this is how it used to be done. Let's say something even like, you know, editing film versus something digital. You see that evolution, you get almost a feel for the work ethic and what went into it. And, of course, there was so much more physical labor in those days, wasn't there? Life, I see from a 21st century perspective, that life 150, 200 years ago was kind of drudgery. I guess people didn't see it that way themselves. I'm not sure.
It was drudgery. As part of the education programs that I teach at the museum, we have a lot of role-playing and a lot of hands-on activities. And when a child picks up a flat iron and feels the weight of it, or pretends to cook something in an iron pot and feels the heft of that, they realize, I always say that colonial housewives were not wimps. They were strong, muscular women, and they had to be. They had to work all day long just to get dinner on the table. And all of those tools that were used to do that are on display at the museum.
When we were speaking here at the radio station in the conference room before going on the air, you said something interesting to me about museums in general. How they live in the past, but they live in the present, they live in the future, they kind of almost supersede time. Tell the audience a little bit about what you said to me there.
They do, and if I can share a quote from Walt Whitman that I think really applies to what we do at the museum, and this is from Leaves of Grass, written in 1900. "There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he'd looked upon, that object he became. And that object became part of him for the day or a certain part of the day or for many years or stretching cycles of years." I think that's really what museums can do for people. By looking at objects, in our case, it's artifacts in an art museum. It would be maybe a painting or a sculpture, that people can become that. They can form a relationship with that, and it sticks with them. And we do know from our school children who visit the museum almost every day, they go home to their families and tell about what they saw. They bring their families back on weekends to show their families what they experienced perhaps just on a little school trip.
I honestly had never heard, and I love museums, I had never heard of your museum. So if anyone's listening to this in the tri-state area or later on the web at njch.org, if you can tell people how to get in touch and find out more, whether it's a website or a phone number, about the Museum of Early Trades and Crafts.
We encourage visitors all the time. Our website for all the updated information is www.metc.org. And our general phone number for speaking to a real person and getting information that way is 973-377-2982.
You seem to be somebody who really loves their job. And as we end this segment, I'd like you to talk about that, the passion that you have for history, for the museum, for its projects, and for your job.
I love my job. You're absolutely right, Bob. I was an English, high school English and drama teacher for 32 years. And when I retired 15 years ago, I decided to reinvent myself. And I had gone to Seton Hall and got a master's degree in museum professions. And this job came up. And I often joke with my visitors and my audiences and say, I still get to teach, but it's the best of both worlds. You don't have to take a test, and I don't have to grade any papers anymore.
That's great. Great talking on this segment with Meg Waste, Curator of Education at the Museum of Early Trades and Crafts in Madison, New Jersey.
Thanks, Bob.
You're listening to Humanities Connection on WFDU 89.1 FM. I'm Bob Mann. This program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. If you want more information about the work of the Council, please go to www.njch.org. There you can hear archives of this program and also find out detailed information about all of the wonderful things that are being done by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Literature is a heritage that belongs to us all. It's not just for the formally educated. Those are the words of Pat Andres, who is my guest on this segment of Humanities Connection. Pat is Executive Director of People and Stories. It's a program designed to create a lifelong love of reading. Pat, thank you very much for agreeing to be in the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Bob. It's an honor and a pleasure.
This sounds like a fascinating program that you have, but normally when people talk about a program that's creating a love of learning and a love of reading, it's aimed at children, mainly school children. But this is a very different target population. You serve more than 40,000 people over the years you have served. So tell us, who are some of the people you're serving and trying to get them to have a real lifelong love of reading?
Yes, we are essentially an adult education program. We work with men and women who are in prisons, in reentry centers, in halfway houses, in adult basic education programs. We also do have a bibliography that's aimed at at-risk youth, so we will meet up with youth in an alternative education program, for example. People and Stories, Gente y Cuentos, was originally in Spanish only. Our founder created the program in Spanish in 1972, and it was in 1987 that the first English program took place, and that was in Trenton, funded by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.
It's interesting that it went from Spanish and expanded into English rather than starting in English and expanding into Spanish. And you do use in your letterhead People and Stories / Gente y Cuentos, because obviously you are geared to two different audiences, and I guess in some cases bilingual audiences.
Exactly. Our founder, Sarah Hirschman, took a seminar with Paulo Freire at Harvard, and she wanted to do with literature what Freire was doing with literacy, which was use the life experiences, the assets of the listener, the participants, as the strongest point of entry into new awarenesses, growth, education, liberation education. So she started with a group of Spanish-speaking women in Cambridge, and they were essentially a group of mothers who had a baby group, and she asked them, would you like to discuss stories from your cultura? And Gente y Cuentos was born, and a number of years later, People and Stories.
Now, the actual operation of it fascinates me, because you really zero in on the short story genre. Why make short stories the central piece, the central genre, as contrasted to novels or any other form of literature? Why the short story?
Well, there are a number of dimensions to that, and the first is logistics. We read the story aloud during a 90-minute session, and the first 20 or 25 minutes is the oral reading. We're inviting participants who may have literacy levels below fifth grade to discuss short stories by James Joyce, Nadine Gordimer, Bernard Malamud, Jorge Luis Borges, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. We're inviting them to discuss these stories. So we present them orally, so there's a level playing field. So the length itself is one thing. Also, the short story genre unlike the novel has the leisure to go on for 250, 300 pages.
Right, you got backstories, for example, and you just don't have that luxury when you're getting to the point in a short story.
Exactly. So therefore, the short story is very poetic. Each word is saturated. It really depends on condensation and saturation. So we'll have a story, for example, James Joyce's Eveline. And one of the opening lines of that story is, "She sat at the window watching the evening invade the avenue." The word invade carries so much of the fear that we learn of later in the story. It carries so much information about the inner landscape of the main character because the short story is a very densely poetic form. And that's one of the reasons why it's so powerful.
What is the role of the facilitator? Is the facilitator someone who reads the story aloud and then is conducting a discussion? What do facilitators do?
Facilitators read the story aloud and conduct the discussion in such a way that their interpretation is not given to the participants. We want to invite the participants to discover for themselves what resonates with them. Why is that image so powerful? One of our stories, for example, by Millie Jafta, there'll be a sequence with end of the week, end of the month, end of the year, and the trip to the north felt hot and unending. Does that tell us anything about the way the participant is feeling? And we gradually draw out from the participants their own interpretations of the story. The Freirean method that we use is sometimes described as midwife teaching, to witness the participants' fragile newborn thoughts before they turn into acceptable lies. That's a quote from Women's Ways of Knowing. And the idea there is not to tell the participants what to think about the story, not to
force it down their throat. You use the word facilitator, Pat, rather than teacher, and I think that's or instructor. I think that's very intentional on your part, right? A facilitator, not an instructor.
Yes, exactly. The facilitator is the co-questioner. The role of the facilitator is to ask questions. We have a method that enables the facilitator to touch on a number of dimensions of the short story because it's essentially a literature program. So we will have questions based on the poetics of the story, the shadows in the story, the ambiguities, the unanswered questions, the themes or issues in the story, or the contrasts in the story. So those are the four categories for questions that come from the story. Then the fifth category we use is from the life experience of the listener. Does this remind you of anything in your own life? Have you met a character like this? So the facilitator is always working to draw out the thoughts, the interpretations of the participants in the group.
Our program, Humanities Connection, is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. You mentioned them briefly before in the early days of People and Stories. What is their involvement right now? What is the NJCH connection?
The NJCH connection continues to be very strong. The New Jersey Council for the Humanities is currently funding our Reading Deeply in Community program, which is also funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And those grants are helping us bring this program to people in homeless shelters in Trenton, and for the National Endowment for the Humanities nationwide. the New Jersey Council for the Humanities grant is funding a Gente Cuentos program at Fort Dix. And that's really a very important program there. So many of the incarcerated population, Spanish speakers, have very few programs offered in Spanish. And the New Jersey Council for the Humanities is helping us take our program there. It's helping us take it to Homefront in Ewing, which is a transitional housing facility for homeless parents.
Well, Pat, let me just read from your background material, which you sent me, some of the populations which are served. People who are in prison but moving to probation. Halfway house residents rejoining the community. At-risk youth, you mentioned those before. Adults enrolled in adult education programs. Immigrants working toward citizenship. Veterans reentering civilian society. Seniors moving to new stages of their lives. And parents who are members of any of the groups that we just listed. Now, my question has to do with a transition beyond people and stories. Gente Cuentos. What happens with the different reading levels? For example, you have a facilitator who's reading the story aloud and then facilitating a discussion. As people in these populations move on, will some of them hit a wall because of literacy concerns? What happens next?
Our mission is to whet the appetite for reading further. So many of our participants report to us that the fire has been lit now. They want to read more. We have participants come back to us and say, I've completed my GED and I want to go on for further education beyond that. I visited one of our programs in Philadelphia recently, a rehab center for women who have experienced substance and physical abuse. And one of the People in Stories participants from a number of years ago was now on staff there. And I'm not sure that we can take credit alone for the life changes that happen. Very often we're meeting with people in programs that are offering a variety of services to the participants. So we're one part of that.
You get it started. As a matter of fact, in a lot of the literature I've read about People and Stories, you use the word ignite a lot. And I guess that's your role. You get them started, and after that, it's up to them as to how much literature and reading is going to meet in their lives.
Yes, we see ourselves as possibly a bridge to further educational programs. One of the responses from participants across the different groups is, no one ever asked me what I thought about these topics before. No one ever listened as deeply to my ideas before. So there's a sense of mastery and accomplishment that we self-consciously try to foster in the groups. I was visiting recently a program in Fort Dix, and the facilitator and I were waiting in the visitors' room for the guard to escort us out. And a young woman came up to our Gente Cuentos facilitator, Marcy Schwartz, who's a professor of Spanish at Rutgers, came up to Marcy and said, I want to thank you so much. On the phone, my father talks so much about the stories that you are reading and discussing each week. And that was a change in itself, that the prisoner could experience joy and pride instead of shame during the visiting hour.
That's a great story, and it's a great way to end the segment, because what you're doing just really does seem to ignite a real love of reading, and I think it must make a huge difference to so many of the people in the populations we discuss. Thank you very much for sharing all of this with us.
Well, thank you so much, Bob, for having me on your program and for your interest in people and stories, gente cuentos. We're delighted.
Pat Andrus talking about people and stories. That's it for this episode of Humanities Connection. I'm Bob Mann. Thank you very much for listening. This program is broadcast on WFDU 89.1 FM on a monthly basis, and then you could hear it as an archive. As a matter of fact, you can hear archives of all of our programs at www.njch.org. And you can go to that website to read about all of the wonderful programs that are funded by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.